This is former FCC Commissioner Mike Copps, and you're listening to WMRWLP in Warren, Vermont.
My name is Amy Hornblass, and I'm here to host the 4-H show. The 4-H's stand for health, happiness, harmony, and humor. And today I have some very, very breaking news for you. So it's going to be kind of a news, breaking news show update on a situation that a lot of folks are really, really interested in, which is masking children in schools. So I have some really, really interesting breaking news on that front. But before we begin, let me remind you that the following program presents the views of its participants and producers. It does not necessarily represent the views of WMRW or its license holder, RootsWork. And thank you for joining me today on WMRW 94.5 FM. LP, streaming out of Warren, Vermont, broadcasting out of Warren, Vermont, and streaming online at WMRW.org. And I am really grateful to be here today. I'm going to be hosting by myself today, but I have brought several voices with me to share with you on these open airwaves. I have not only expert testimony on the harms of masks, from America's Frontline Industrial Hygienist Multidisciplinary Support Summit, which happened last fall. So I have a couple of testimonies from there, but I also have a couple of testimonies from Vermonters, testimony that Vermonters have presented at school board meetings, particularly a school board meeting near me in Danville, Vermont. So I have a couple of local voices too, so that we can sort of compare what the actual on-the-ground testimony from parents is telling us, and then hear from the experts. And the reason why we're doing this in particular today is because we have some breaking news, folks, on the level of the Agency of Education. See, I have submitted several FOIA requests over the past few years, Freedom of Information requests, because I was not able to get answers from my local school administrators, superintendents. So I have gone up to the Agency of Education, and a few weeks ago, the Agency of Education confirmed that they have absolutely no evidence that masks are safe for children. None. This is the Vermont Agency of Education responded to my FOIA request, and that is what they said. So let that sink in. No evidence of safety. Why? Why don't we have any studies looking at children in masks for more than just a few minutes? Why? After 3 years of masking children in the schools. And masks have been required for most, not all, school children in Vermont for the past 2 years. But most schools, there were a few schools who did not mask, and there were many schools around the country who did not mask and who are now not masking. However, under guidance from the U.S. Department of Education, some schools are and will continue, if we allow this, will continue to require masks of certain students and classrooms and teachers and staff based on special education rules. Using the IEP and 504 process, schools like Newark School in Newark, Vermont, which is over there by Burke, they are requiring masks of several classrooms and children and staff through using the IEP process. So this is a team of special educators and school professionals who have been given this authority, or they presume to have. Let me correct myself. They presume that they have this authority based on this letter of guidance from the U.S. Department of Education. So I figured this was something people are very, very interested in, and I wanted to bring you all the latest. So I'm going to be updating you on that. I'm going to be reading a letter that I've written to the Agency of Education, an open letter, which describes all of this, and also presenting testimony. And all of this can be found at my website, vtmasksurvey.com. That's VT, like Vermont, masksurvey.com. And coming up in just a second, let's start out with a neurosurgeon. Huh, do you think neurosurgeons know anything about masks and how they're used in surgery or how they may affect neural development? Well, this doctor certainly does. Dr. Avery Jackson, presenting at America's Frontline Industrial Hygienist Multidisciplinary Support Summit. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Jackson.
Now, speaking of neuro issues from wearing masks, I would like to introduce the amazing and selfless neurosurgeon, Dr. Avery Jackson, who has absolutely stood his ground on understanding the harms of masking.
Thank you. Kristen is just absolutely awesome. You know, and I'll just say, as a neurosurgeon, you know, my profession is such that I operate in the hospital and I wear masks, you know, pretty much every day of my professional life for 20 years. And she's really, really right on. And I'm so glad that I'm allowed to give my presentation after hers. You know, I'm in the operating room. There is amazing ventilation. It's really cold as a neurosurgeon, and I'm standing anywhere from 2 hours to 18 hours, and I'm operating. And I tell you what, there's a huge difference with all those control mechanisms in the operating room. And as soon as I leave the operating room, there is a complete difference in how I feel and breathing with the surgical masks, let alone the N95s. And so immediately I rip that thing off my face. Well, the problem was we were at a specific hospital, knowing that these are not good for our health and others, knowing how it feels to wear a mask all day, knowing how it feels, you know, when you take that mask off so you can breathe appropriately, and seeing in a particular hospital all the patients in every bed, and they're you know, kind of at about 4 feet, you know, with their heads elevated, with no masks. All the professionals in the hospital, when they're in the cafeteria, are sitting down, no masks, and yet you were required to wear a mask when you're standing. So as a neurosurgeon, that makes just like, it's not logical, it makes no sense, right? So basically, it's almost as though I would be okay if I just crouch down at 4 feet, and I'm at the same level as every person in the beds across, you know, however many hundreds of people, because that's what's happening in the hospital. But yet, because of the fact that masks weren't worn, we were suspended. And when asked about suspension, it turns out it wasn't that we were harm to patients or others. It was that we didn't follow a specific protocol that had no logic to it. So I'm like, wow. So as a neurosurgeon, I deal with life and death situations every day, and saving people and taking skulls off and taking tumors out of their brain and so forth. And now I'm forced to fight a different evil, a different battle, you know, that's not backed up by science. And, you know, and so that's the experience that we had. You know, C.S. Lewis notes that if you look for truth, you may find comfort in the end. If you look for comfort, you will not get either comfort or truth, only soft soap and wishful thinking to begin, and in the end, despair. And if we continue along this path, that's exactly where we're going to be. As a physician, when you are presenting at a scientific conference or any conference, you are required to talk about your disclosures or lack thereof. And yet, over the last 2 years, we've seen mitigation on that specific requirement as it relates to vaccines and masks and a whole bunch of stuff, but I'm, you know, programmed to do that. So there you go. So, so for me, my time as a neurosurgeon I've been interested in the respiratory function, and it began early on in my personal and professional career. Not only did I have asthma when I was a young boy and kind of dealing with that, but in medical school at Wayne State, I worked with on the cross phrenic reflex and that and how it affects respiratory function in the rat model. And then in my neurosurgery residency and training at Penn State University, I had a combined experience in pediatric neurosurgery and adult neurosurgery over the course of the 5-year period. And during that time, I wrote and received a peer-reviewed grant on shaken baby syndrome, where we reviewed our experience in the signs of this devastating form of abuse leading to not only brain injury, but pulmonary compromise. And more importantly, with knowing the pediatric brain development and injury issues from 20 years ago, 30 years ago almost now, and the respiratory dysfunction, this mask issue and some of the concerns that we all share as it relates to masking and mandating, especially even our children to mask, has been a problem. So over the last 18 years, I've done 10,000 surgeries and I've seen 100,000 patients in my clinics. And occasionally I would experience some of those toxic effects of mask wearing as I just mentioned to you. So that's why right out of the operating room, I pull off the mask so that I can breathe now that I'm in a different environment that's not as controlled. And so one of the things that I noted early on is that there is an extreme difference in respiratory quality when I don and doff my surgical mask every day. But what really got me was when my 9-year-old daughter, who was initially wearing the masks at our school early on, began to have headaches and began to complain of concentration issues. Then that really led me on a journey to understand how I, as her dad, could advocate for her and people like her. I heard more and more reports about it. And so then I went on my journey. And so on my journey, one of the papers that I encountered is what you see here, the effects of carbon dioxide on brain excitability and electrolytes. And that's by Woodbury. And in this paper, it talks about the effects of various concentrations of carbon dioxide on brain excitability and the electrolyte distribution in the rat model, and also properties of seizures that were induced by abrupt withdrawal or change from higher levels of carbon dioxide. So the assumption would be wearing a mask increases carbon dioxide levels. And so then when you do get home or you get to a different place and you take the mask off, what are the negative effects? So we're not looking at that, but in children and in adults, that plays a huge role. And so thus the effects of carbon dioxide on brain excitability is related to concentrations of inhaled carbon dioxide. So in the abrupt removal of these higher levels of carbon dioxide, spontaneous clonic seizures occurred within 60 seconds to 1 minute after withdrawal of the carbon dioxide in this model. And there was decrease in intracellular concentrations of sodium and potassium, as well as marked cellular acidosis. So basically destruction of brain tissue also occurred and was documented postmortem. In this next study that I looked at, the effects of carbon dioxide exposure on early brain activity and development in the rat, noted in Biotechnique and Histochemistry by Curé et al., both, as you can see here, at University of Elul as well as Mayo Clinic, they looked at the developing brain and its vulnerability to certain environmental factors, and specifically the effects of air and carbon dioxide. They focused on the circuitry involving the neurobiology of anxiety, spatial learning, memory, and on insulin-like growth factor, which are known to play, it's known to play a role in early brain development in the rat model. So spatial learning and memory were impaired by exposure to carbon dioxide, and elevated blood cortisol levels intensified anxiety behaviors as well. They also noted that brain cell numbers were decreased in the hippocampus, and that's the memory part of the brain, and the prefrontal cortex. So after 0.3% air exposure in the adolescent rats. So there's a positive correlation was noted between blood IGF-1 levels and apoptosis, which is programmed brain cell death. So again, there's a correlation here of literal cell death when there's increased carbon dioxide exposure. So these findings were associated with increased anxiety behavior, impaired memory and learning. And so the study demonstrates that the negative effects of higher carbon dioxide levels on the developing brain in rats was an issue, and the negative effect on stopping higher carbon dioxide level exposure as well. Next slide. So now we look at the human model, and we have this study on the influence of carbon dioxide and brain activity and metabolism in conscious humans. And this is in the Journal of Cerebral Blood Flow Metabolism by Fang Zhu et al., University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center. And they endeavored to gain a better understanding of carbon dioxide's effect on brain activity. And this study investigated how increase in blood carbon dioxide levels by inhaled carbon dioxide alters brain activity in humans, since we noted these findings in other groups or populations. So it basically, in a nutshell, looked at three different techniques to assess the effects of carbon dioxide on brain activity. They compared the participants' cerebral metabolism levels when breathing carbon dioxide-enriched gases to breathing normal room air gases. They investigated the spontaneous neural activity under normal carbon dioxide levels and then high carbon dioxide levels by performing functional connectivity MRI. Then they looked at brain electrical activity via EEG, or the brain waves, under room air, and compared that to the carbon dioxide breathing conditions in healthy human subjects. And so their cerebral metabolism was measured and the electrical activity, the EEG recordings, were taken. Overall, the data showed a suppressive effect of carbon dioxide on brain activity. So this study represented one of the first systematic investigations on the effect of in conscious humans, suggesting that resting state brain or neural activity is reduced due to mildly high carbon dioxide levels. So further, they show that this suppression of neural activity is accompanied by a reduction in metabolic brain activity. So basically, your metabolism and how it functions and controls the fuels that it uses has also been compromised in this particular state. So these findings suggest that increased carbon dioxide levels cause the brain to reduce metabolism, as well as reduce spontaneous activity, neural activity or electrical activity, and enter into a lower arousal state while wearing masks or being in a situation where there is increased carbon dioxide. All of the above scientific evidence confirms that prolonged exposure to carbon dioxide decreases brain activity and metabolism. And this would also occur when wearing PPE and facial coverings. So you think about it for a second. You know, we look at our children who've been exposed to these masks without control, been exposed to higher carbon dioxide levels, and we say, what's wrong with you? Why do you have headaches? Why are you dizzy? Why are you passing out when you're playing sports when you have these masks on? And, you know, we look at also adults who have pulmonary or pre-existing cerebral or brain dysfunction, dementia, and neurodegenerative disorders or brain injury. And we see that there's been changes emotionally and mentally, as well as physically, with prolonged exposure to these carbon dioxide levels when wearing the masks. And so there's that transition, as I mentioned to you, from normal carbon dioxide levels when you take the mask off, from high levels to normal levels, and those results. And that's why so many people have been very sedate and even tired afterwards, especially our kids. And then the effects on their brain activity, resulting in poor school work and also inattention, as well as even up to seizure activity. So that's a real problem. Next slide. So this was a study done in Germany looking at children who were forced to wear masks. Next slide. And what was found in this study is there were 17,840 parents who were interviewed based on their observations of that they had with their children. Next slide. And what they found was between these age groups, 0 to 6, 7 to 12, and 13 to 18 years, that 66.4% of the age group of 13 to 18 were able to express that they had headaches while mask wearing. 54% of those 7 to 12, and then 53% or 24% of those 0 to 6. Also, concentration difficulties, as you can see, was in the 60%. They also noted that there was some impaired learning of 50%, and then drowsiness roughly of 50%, as well as difficulty or shortness of breath at about 34%. Next slide. And so when they looked at the child's emotional status, they noted that in the age group of 13 to 18 years, 66% of those children were more often irritated than usual. And also in terms of being less cheerful, 50% as well. And so they noted that there was more restlessness and there were changes, as I mentioned, in the rat model translated in the human model in these children. So there were major effects clinically that were noted. Next slide. And so one of the conclusions that the investigators reached was clear and broadly diversified burden of complaints, both in the physical, such as the rashes, headaches, and so forth, as well as in the mental, fears, irritability, et cetera, and intellectual concentration disorders in these areas in children of the interviewees. This was what was noted. In addition to acute health impairment with, in individual cases, significantly experienced health impairments, the long-term effects of the various developmental areas that go beyond well-being, such as language, play, learning, communication, sensomotoric development, empathy of children are difficult to assess, and empathy. The often mentioned headaches and concentration difficulties should be seriously explored in their importance for cognitive development. It is noticeable that the distribution of complaints fits well with the age of the children, which supports the plausibility of the parental input. So it all makes sense. So the question, of course, the direct effect of indoor carbon dioxide concentrations in cognitive functions, and that it's been demonstrated in the literature before. Next slide. And so there are multiple conclusions. One of the ones that was reached was that there's a certain percentage of children and adolescents have non-negligible complaints when wearing the masks. These children should not be stigmatized. So that was also a big issue in terms of the social piece. This worldwide registry on side effects of the mask reflects the spectrum of symptoms in children and adults. So again, these are really important encounters to note early on. Next slide. These are some of the resources. Next slide. Okay, and next slide. So we were asked to write mask waivers for children, and we happily did that because these children literally came to me as a brain surgeon and said, or the parents said, my children, they're having headaches, they're having dizziness. Can you help? So, of course, as a neurosurgeon, I'm going to be helpful. And I said, well, let's take off the mask and see what happens. And guess what? They got better. The headaches went away. How about that, right? So this is one of the kids wrote to me later after this mask exemption. And he says, dear Dr. Jackson, thank you for making my exemption so fast, taking my exemption for the mask so fast. I really, really appreciate it. It means so much to me. Also, masks suck. Next slide. Here's another one. Dr. Jackson, my husband and I cannot express our gratitude enough for what you did for our girls. Since they have ditched the masks, both have had higher grades and test scores, and that was only in the first few weeks. They aren't as tired when they get home and have been more pleasant to be around, right? So everything that I just mentioned to you scientifically, as a physician, clinically, is seen here.
All right, folks. So you were just listening to Dr. Avery Jackson presenting, his presentation at the America's Frontline Industrial Hygienists Multidisciplinary Support Summit, which happened in the fall of 2022. So this is hot off the press information. And I am here today. My name is Amy Hornblass, here for the 4-H show. And we are discussing the harms of masks with children, namely because the Agency of Education here in Vermont has admitted that it has absolutely no evidence that masks are safe for children. And so what there appears to be is there appears that there has been absolutely no cost-benefit analysis conducted on the use of masks anywhere, whether it's in response to COVID-19, and especially in schools. There has been a lot of pressure and a lot of questions being raised by people. Why don't we have this evidence of safety? And so when we do a cost-benefit analysis, say on the use of masks or any other medical intervention, first of all, we have to establish, the harm side of the equation. And that's what we're doing here today. We are comparing evidence of safety for masks in kids versus evidence of harm. And so we know there is no evidence of safety. It would be unethical to conduct such a study because of the known harms that could occur. And so we're looking at the harms because that's what we're left with. That's all that's left on the table. And so even if we have some good positive things that might come from wearing masks, those positives do not eliminate these harms. And when we're talking about cognitive, brain damage, seizures, permanent damage to hearts and kidneys and things, we are violating the rule, first do no harm. And that is a serious one. First do no harm. Otherwise, you're not helping. and that's why it's important to do this analysis. So I'm going to read for you a letter that I wrote, an open letter to Secretary French, who is the Secretary of the Agency of Education, and the Vermont State Board of Education. And you can find all of these resources on my website, vtmasksurvey.com, as well as all the links to the references, because it is really important that people cite their references. If they make a statement, right, especially with something this important, they need to back it up with data, and I do. So, January 12th, 2023. Dear Secretary French and the Vermont State Board of Education, most schools in Vermont have required students and staff to wear masks over their noses and mouths at all times in order to attend school and participate in activities since 2020. Last spring, Secretary French urged schools to drop their mask requirements. And here I link to the VT Digger article where you can find out more details about what he said and what was going on there. He urged, Secretary French of the AOE, urged schools to drop their mask requirements. Yet schools in Vermont are continuing to mask students and staff again this year through a confidential process using special education laws. And there I do provide the link to the U.S. Department of Education letter, which was sent out to schools last March, outlining how they feel they are, should do this, providing guidance around that. Most schools assume that if the Agency of Education is allowing schools to make children wear masks, they must have ample evidence to assure concerned parents that it is safe. However, after 3 years of mask mandates in Vermont schools, we finally have this admission by the Vermont Agency of Education. In response to your public records request dated January 9th, 2023, seeking, quote, public records that contain any evidence the Agency of Education has used to determine that the use of face masks are safe for any age student, including students with special health needs, both for prolonged and short periods of time. So that was the question that I asked. Do they have any evidence that they have used to determine that masks are safe for any students for any amount of time? And this was their response. After consulting with relevant agency staff, I can and do certify that no records as specified by your request exist at this agency. If the AOE possesses no evidence of safety, then there is only the evidence of harm to consider. For 3 years, school administrators have been hearing complaints from parents, students, and staff. Not only has there been public testimony at school board meetings, which I do provide a link to my website where I provide examples of this public testimony, but complaints have been received behind the scenes as well. Through a Freedom of Information Act request last spring, I acquired all the email correspondences concerning masks to and from the superintendent of the Caledonia Central Supervisory Union. These emails show that as soon as school began in the fall of 2020, the district received complaints. One student received treatment at the emergency room. Families pulled their children from school, and staff resigned. Compliance issues arose, and staff were reprimanded for pulling their masks down below their noses in hot kitchens. Many of the complaints were identical with the types of hazards known to be caused by wearing PPE. The symptoms people are suffering in Vermont schools as a result of wearing masks are precisely those described by the World Health Organization, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and the Occupational Health and Safety Administration. In July of 2021, I wrote an open letter to your agency referencing all of these resources, describing the basic OSHA workplace protections which your agency is not granting to the children and staff in your schools, and asking the board to make a plan to assess and address the harms being done. Educators are not PPE experts, nor are they trained in the proper supervision of respiratory protection, yet they feel they are empowered and even required to mask themselves and others under the authority of the AOE. School board members are not only squelching efforts to raise this issue at public meetings, but have also asked staff and board members not to read correspondence from or respond to concerned members of the public. The Agency of Education needs to step up and provide clear guidance based on the evidence, since the legal ramifications of its inaction continue to mount. There are numerous laws and regulations being violated, and it is only a matter of time before the courts recognize this. A recent Vermont court decision regarding the authority of school boards to impose mask mandates on students cited Title 16 of the Vermont statutes, which says that school boards may take any action that is required for the sound administration of the school. There doesn't appear to be a legal definition for the word sound, but common definitions include unharmed, healthy, and a sound policy would consider long-term consequences over all groups of people, not just the good intentions behind the policy. Whatever school boards decide about the soundness of using masks, the final decision as to whether or not an action is sound is to be made by the secretary, as Section 16 VSA continues. The secretary, with the advice of the Attorney General, upon application of a school board, shall decide whether any action contemplated or taken by a school board under the subdivision is required for the sound administration of a school district. So it is time to stop passing the buck, Secretary French and the Board of Education. The responsibility for deciding what is sound policy in Vermont schools lies with you. Deferring to the Department of Health is not acceptable. If the Department of Health possessed any evidence to support the use of masks in schools, why haven't they shared it by now? As the final decision maker, this is information Secretary French should already possess. Secretary French has already urged schools not to reimpose mask mandates or follow CDC guidance concerning community infection levels because they are irrelevant to our small state. By these actions, he acknowledges that federal, quote, guidance does not supersede the secretary's authority or responsibility. Now is time to stand by those decisions based on his own authority and backed by the evidence. A thorough and transparent assessment of the use of masks in Vermont schools will assure the public that his decisions on these matters are sound. And now we're going to hear from a parent at the Danville school board meeting.
I mean, our job is to develop them at home. Your job is to teach them reading, writing, arithmetic, science, whatever. So, I mean, I want them there with you. And I want them to have the chance to develop and be around their friends and everything. But I don't want them there choking on their mask all day. Our children complain about this. I'm sure you guys see it in the classroom. Those of you who deal with it, I'm sure it's very stressful on your end. We also hear about it every single night, how they hate wearing the mask, how, they get headaches and it's not good for them. And it is giving them social issues as well. My youngest son prefers to put a mask, or did until this past summer, preferred to put a mask on when he met new people because it made him, he could cover his face up. That's not okay with me. That's not normal. It's just another thing to consider. I just want you to all consider every aspect of it.
Parents tonight. I am one that does believe there is a time and a place for mask use, and I have used them myself a lot in the last 18 months, but I do have some concerns that I just want to express. So one, I have seen masks come home on my three children that are sopping wet. It's disgusting. Saturated with just, you know, their breath, condensation, food particles. Sometimes they're crusty, so you can tell that it's gunk from earlier in the day that has dried on. One of my boys complains about headaches. Another one gets eczema all around his mouth, despite washing it twice a day at least. And then I have a little three-year-old that's in preschool this year, and this is her first time going to school. And, you know, it's just seeing her muzzled with that thing when she gets on the bus and having a hard time keeping it on her face. Her teacher actually reached out to me and asked if I was concerned about Natalie's speech. And I said, no, actually, she's my three kids. She's the most eloquent. She has a wonderful vocabulary. I can understand her 99.9% of the time. Why? She says, I just have a really hard time understanding her. And I there was, you know, a couple times in the morning, getting ready for waiting for the bus while she has her mask on. And yeah, you can't understand her. So I'm concerned that she's going to be suffering being masked at school. Her teacher's having a hard time understanding her. The kids communicating with each other. So that's a concern.
All right, so I'm gonna be brief, hopefully. I'm usually to the point and pretty data driven. And what I wanna talk about today is the detriment of masking. And when I think about this, I really think about our children because we're forcing them to do something. You're an adult. You can quit your job. You can walk away. You can do many things. But our children have been placed in harm's way, especially. And especially when I think about the psychological impacts of children that really psychologically need to be in a school environment with other children, that psychologically need to be in a sport. And so they're willing to play the sport with the mask on, which puts the parent in a terrible position, knowing the deep psychological need on one hand and the potential physical harm on the other. Much like much of what has happened when
First of all, I was like Megyn Kelly and Tammy. I didn't think there was any way they were going to mask people. It was just so ludicrous at every level. We know that viruses go through N95 masks, and that the N95 masks, actually you breathe out the virus. It's to protect you, not to protect others, right? So we knew that the masks were ineffective. I couldn't even have that conversation for 6 months because it just seemed nonsensical to me. So we've known from the beginning, and anybody who was trained as we were knew. And that's why it was such a smack in the face, because this should be obvious to anyone who's trained in similar fields. And so I felt the same way. You heard during Dr. Jackson's talk, those children saying, well, I can't breathe. I mean, this is not that complicated, right? And so, but yet we're acting like, what do you mean you can't breathe because you're running in the rain cross country with a wet mask on your mouth? Like, I'm just kidding, you know, and the moms, it's like, you know, we're standing back when we really just needed to slap somebody upside the head. All right, so what, so now I'll get a little bit more into the deep biochemistry of this. What signals our body on whether we are getting enough oxygen or not? It's not actually our oxygen concentration. It's our carbon dioxide concentration. When our carbon dioxide concentration goes up too high, it signals our body, hey, you need more oxygen. What should you do? You should breathe. You should breathe faster. You should breathe deeper. But, and so usually that's enough to bring the body back into homeostasis. What is homeostasis? It means balance, but it's really a deeper balance. It's a biochemical balance. And when your body's not in balance, if it gets too far out of balance, you actually die. If you've ever, like I'm about 50 years old, if you've ever been out of homeostasis because of hormonal problems or not being able to breathe, you feel like you're going to die. And so it's really important to maintain that balance, to maintain that homeostasis. So when someone has a mask on, and everyone's biochemistry is different, so some people are going to be far more susceptible than others, and your carbon dioxide raises to a certain level, it triggers a homeostatic response that says, breathe deeper, breathe faster. And so you breathe deeper and breathe faster. What does that do? That makes more carbon dioxide that tells your body to do the exact same thing. So pretty soon you're kind of hyperventilating in your mask. And for many people, it's, you know, you know you're not getting enough oxygen. And so you have an anxiety attack, a panic attack, and there's just a feeling of not being able to breathe. And yet we're telling our children to harm themselves. They know they're harming themselves at either a conscious or unconscious level, and just to keep doing it. That's grooming. All right. So increased carbon dioxide tells the body to try to get more oxygen by increasing respiration and to establish homeostasis. So now you're hyperventilating, and it also increases your heart rate because it's like we need more oxygen to the tissues. It's assuming that you don't have something covering your mouth, because who would be that stupid? All right, your body's assuming that. So you're going to take in more oxygen, but you're not taking more oxygen. So it's going to increase your heart rate in order to get that oxygen to the tissues, except for you're not taking in more oxygen. You're breathing more CO2. So now you're hyperventilating. You've got increased heart rate and increased cardiac output. You have put the body under a lot of cardiovascular stress. So I allowed my 18-year-old to work with a mask on, very light work, mostly standing around, because he was 18. My daughter is epileptic. Under no circumstances would I allowed her to wear a mask. My son, I'm like, yeah, you know, I mean, if you wanted to go to war and get shot at, I'd let you do that too. And I'm not sure which, you know, yeah, which is worse, right? But, you know, I once had a student tell me, well, you know, I OD'd on cocaine. Why am I still alive? And I said, well, because you're 18. Right? An 18-year-old standing around in a mask is not the same as a 45-year-old or a 65-year-old or someone with hypertension or someone with diabetes. All right? All of these things need to be taken into account. So now you're hyperventilating, you've got increased heart rate, increased cardiac output, your body is under cardiovascular stress. And in extreme cases, depending on your pathophysiology, your age, your physical conditioning, you can go into cardiac overload. In extreme cases, you can go into respiratory arrest, and this is going to be most likely under exercise conditions. And I have to tell you, my son ran cross country. I remember his first race. I was really hopeful because he's Ethiopian and we know they can fly. And he didn't come in first or second or even 30th, But when he came in, his eyes were as big as saucers, and he was like, "Mom, that is the hardest thing I have ever done." And so luckily he had gone on to college as I watched on YouTube as children were wearing masks in the rain so that they had no permeability while running 3 miles cross country. And like many of us, I hadn't sworn for about 20 years. I decided it was inappropriate, right? Not very professional. But at some point, you've just like, what? All right, so under these conditions of hypercapnia, you are making so much CO2 that yes, you can go under respiratory arrest. At a previous function that we had earlier this year, that happened to a student. And he is forever changed. He is forever disabled because he went past that threshold. And when you get past that threshold, you go into cardiac arrest. Then you're talking about ischemia. You're talking about lack of oxygen. You're talking about brain damage, permanent brain damage from lack of oxygen. Now, my physiological, biochemical opinion is that any kid that is wearing a mask, and probably any human being, 8 hours a day or 6 hours a day without proper ventilation is probably having some level of brain damage, all right? Some level of damage, all right? Maybe low level, but that's also going to depend on their particular biochemical state and their pathophysiology. What have they got going on? All right, so there are extreme cases, but most of the time we're talking about chronic high CO2. You're wearing a mask all day. You're experiencing high carbon dioxide all day. That's called hypercapnia. So I'm going to repeat that word many times. What are the effects of chronic hypercapnia? Well, we actually have a model. COPD is a model of chronic hypercapnia because there is not sufficient gas exchange. So what do we see in people where we have models? Sleep apnea is also another model. All right, so we know what this looks like in people. We know that hypercapnia or increased CO2 impairs kidneys functions. Your kidneys are actually trying to decrease the level of acidity in your blood. And so they're actually really doing a lot to retain, basically to balance the pH. And so it really puts a lot of stress on the kidneys to balance the pH and balance your salt. And it reduces blood flow to the kidneys. And it actually, in many cases, can lead to chronic kidney inflammation, which we refer to nephritis. No one's even talking about this. Anybody measuring in our kids? No, I don't think so. All right. We have a sleep apnea model of hypercapnia, and that also causes a lack of oxygen. And what they see in these people is altered postural stability, altered ability to sense their environment, known as proprioception, altered gait, and increased falls. All right, and this is what it looks like when your brain's not getting an oxygen. This isn't rocket science, okay? In the context of our children, their brains are still developing. And yet we think it's okay to deprive them chronically of oxygen. We have mitochondria that produce our energy, and there's biochemical evidence that this is damaging the mitochondria because they're trying to work in an environment where it doesn't have what it needs. Again, the body is out of homeostasis, and it's put in a place where it's constantly trying to adjust, but it can't adjust because you won't take the mask off. My daughter, as I said, is epileptic, and she has seizures. I was stunned when her neurologist was willing to actually give a written statement that said that there was no way that the mask wearing could induce seizures. When you just heard Dr. Avery Jackson say that as you take off the mask and the oxygen comes back, and I can think of many biochemical mechanisms for this, it can trigger seizures. I knew that. I had the scientific papers that I actually sent to them. That didn't bother them at all. Of course, there was no way I was going to send my child to school with a mask. All right, one of the more concerning aspects of chronic hypercapnia is acidosis. This is the increase of carbonic acid as you put CO2 into the system. And we know that when the body becomes chronically acidic, it is permissive for cancer. How do we know this? Because we see it in the COPD model that they have higher rates of cancer due to chronic hypercapnia. We've already seen skyrocketing increases in the rates of cancer in our children. Our school is in a very small town, and the whole time I've been there, there have been at least 3 children at any given time with cancer in a school of 300 children. That alone is not acceptable, and we should be looking at why. And then we're going to mask our children, knowing that if they have cancer, it's going to be very permissive and feed that cancer, knowing that it may be permissive for getting cancer, because we are 2.5 years out. When are we going to stand up? All right. So if you are a medical professional, you may be thinking, yeah, like you're full of it, because we know that permissive hypercapnia can be anti-inflammatory. So if you're having surgery, a lot of times they'll actually permit a certain increase in CO2 in your body because it's anti-inflammatory. And when you're having surgery or something, that can be helpful for the short term. However, even in that case, they still see that hypercapnia leads to pulmonary edema, which means fluid in your lungs. They still see that it actually reduces cellular healing in the lungs as well. So even though it has some benefits because it's anti-inflammatory, it's a mixed response. However, what about chronic hypercapnia? Increases in CO2 shut down. The reason it's anti-inflammatory is it shuts down a gene called NF-kappa-B. And this is related to cytokine signaling because NF-kappa-B is the gene that needs to be turned on to turn on all your inflammatory cytokines. Well, you're like, well, we don't want to turn on inflammatory cytokines. Well, if you're in the middle of COVID, you don't want them to get any higher. But what if you actually contract some sort of bacterial infection or viral infection? You actually do want to turn on your immune system. So what chronic hypercapnia does is it turns down or inhibits this gene, and it is immunosuppressive. We know it's immunosuppressive because, again, we have these models of COPD where we see an immunosuppressive effect that is followed by increased incidence of chronic lung bacterial infections, increases in the number of bacterial infections in people who are chronically hypercapnic. So we put a mask on our kids that they're breathing into, getting nice and wet all day, walking to the bathroom, dropping on the floor, picking it up, putting it back on their face, breathing moist environment, and then we'll suppress their immune system during a pandemic. Brilliant. All right, so as I said, the immunosuppressive effects of chronic hypercapnia are not theoretical. We've actually seen this in this model of COPD. The next thing I want to talk about is exercising with a mask. Again, my son had cross-country, so I actually saw some of these cases where they were running cross-country with masks on. And we're just fortunate that more kids didn't have very critical reactions to that. All right? When you have acute hypercapnia, and so this is generally exercise-induced, and we're seeing our kids play basketball with masks on, this acute hypercapnia impairs electrical signaling in the heart. It impairs electrical signaling in the heart. I'm not going to go into all of the potassium and the calcium and the sodium, all right? But that data is out there. We know that it results in a regular heartbeat. It results in fluttering of the heart, which is tachycardia, increased heart rate. And it predisposes to sudden cardiac death. Now, again, this is going to be rare, but when you're talking about something that's completely preventable because nobody needs to be running back and forth on the basketball court with a mask on, it's inexcusable. And it's inexcusable that we don't go and slap somebody upside the head for trying to make our children do this. All right, it significantly disrupts, as again, ion and salt balance, all of this membrane polarization by which the heart signals and starts knowing when to contract and when to release, when to contract and when to release. It screws it up, and that's why it contributes to sudden cardiac arrest. It can also, as I said, when you get CO2 above a certain level, it actually signals the brain. The brain is trying to slow the metabolism down because it's saying you don't have enough oxygen to do what you're doing, but your will is keeping you doing it anyway. And so eventually it just says, okay, I'm just shutting this off. You have respiratory arrest, And now nobody's getting any oxygen until either somebody restarts your heart. Now, if you're 18, your heart probably will restart, but how much damage will have been done in the interim? And that's what we need to be asking. As we comply, how much damage is being done in the interim? Mask wearing is putting our kids at risk for chronic respiratory, cardiorespiratory stress, for hypoxia, which is low oxygen, for impaired kidney function and kidney inflammation, for altered posture, gait, and sensing, as Dr. Jackson was talking about, for all sorts of brain dysfunction and lowered function of the brain, for seizures in those who are predisposed, for acidosis, which is permissive for cancer growth, for immunosuppression during a pandemic, and for increased bacterial infection and other infection. And in extreme cases, usually involving exercise, the possibility of respiratory arrest, brain damage, and even sudden cardiac death. What the hell are we thinking? Our children who are not at risk for severe COVID and don't have enough ACE2 receptors in their lungs to sustain an active infection in the lungs and cause lung symptoms are the ones that we're masking every day in school because they can't say no or quit their job. It is time for us to stand up and actually follow the science and just say no more. Thank you.
Well, folks, thank you for joining me today. We were just listening to Dr. Christina Parks, and she was just talking about the detriment of masks, particularly with children. And she was speaking at America's Frontline Industrial Hygienists Multidisciplinary Support Summit. So not hygienists, sorry, hygienists. Multidisciplinary Support Summit. And today we are talking about the harms of masks for children because I am putting out a call to the Secretary of the Agency of Education of Vermont, as well as the Board of Education for the Agency of Education of Vermont, to be heroes, to go down as heroes in history, because, you know, it turns out the Agency of Education has no evidence masks are safe. So that only leaves us with this mountain of evidence that they're harmful, including testimony from people, from parents, from kids. And you can find all of that at my website, vtmasksurvey.com, VT like Vermont, masksurvey.com, as well as previous episodes of the show, the 4-H show. And we always have a series of amazing guests. We're going to have a few more next week, so I hope you'll join me again. And I'm going to wind up the discussion right now for this first hour so that it can be rebroadcast at the station here, WMRW, later in the week. I'm really glad about that. But I am going to continue the conversation. So if you want to stick around, we're going to go a little bit deeper for a few more minutes. Thank you for listening. Have a great day. So, it's the top of the hour, folks, and I want to let you know that you are listening to WMRWLP, Warren, Vermont, at 94.5 on the dial. You can also find us streaming at WMRW.org. You can also find us for up to 2 weeks on the archive at WMRW.org. And the following program presents, and the preceding program, I should say, since we're still continuing with the 4-H show, the following and preceding program presents the views of its participants and producers. It does not necessarily represent the views of WMRW or its license holder, RootsWork. And so we're going to lighten up for a moment, because it is always good to stay on the lighter side to keep our brains ready to listen and love each other. So this song's about love, because that's what it's all about.